Okay, everybody. So we're back, and this is the whole reason I wanted to bring Pete Charette back to Game of Crimes for a second interview. As you heard in the first episode, he was originally interviewed back in April of 2023 on episode 92. If you've ever heard about the French Connection, if you've seen the movie about the French Connection, if you've read a book about the French Connection, but now you want to know the truth, go listen to episode 92, because the man with me today is the man that did the undercover. For how many years was it, Pete? Like 3 years, I think you just said?
6 years.
6 years. Holy cow. So you want to know the truth, this is the place to come for the truth, all right? But the reason I want to bring Pete back is because he was involved in one of the largest cocaine conspiracy cases, probably the largest, I believe you said, in the history of the United States. It's an operation that was called Operation Southern Comfort, just like the liquor bottle. It's a case that I heard about, and an operation that I heard about over the years. I never was involved with it directly, only in a peripheral role, but I can't wait to find out what all happened here. So, Pete, I don't want to waste any more time. I want us to spend some time here. And if you can outline how this case got started and what your role was and the geographical areas that it involved and the amount of drugs and the amount of money and the amount of arrest and just wow. That's what I want to hear.
Well, Steve, I was the supervisor in Atlanta. I left France and then went to South Carolina. Right? I was the RAC in South Carolina. Two-man office, me and one agent, Norm Schumard, God rest his soul, he's passed away. And when I got to South Carolina was corrupt as can be. Marijuana coming into the state like you wouldn't believe. Politicians crooked, etc. And so I went from a one-man office. When I got there, there was only one case on the book. And the previous gentleman that was the agent in charge had retired, has passed away. But his philosophy was no cases, no problem. Lots of cases, big problem. And yeah. So I had a meeting with Norm. And as a result, I had a meeting with Norm and the secretary. And I said, look, there's one case. And there's a reason why I'm straightening out the office and to make cases. And I'll guarantee you by 1 year from now, we're going to be the number one office in the United States with cases. So Norm and I started, and we made cases with the help of the Sheriff's Department, which I had liaison there, all the police departments in the state, SLED, State Bureau, Narcotics Division, and I had a meeting with them, and I said, look, I'm here to clean up the problem in the state because it's affecting not only your state, but nationwide, and they're using your state. My goal is to bring these SOB to jail and put a stop to them. I don't care if they're politicians. I don't care if they're cops, sheriffs. We're going to take them down. And the SLED guys and the sheriff's deputy, I said, you guys, I can't get a task force here, but I'd like to do an ad hoc task force on my own. You guys have a very low budget to make cases. I got the money. In those days, the RACs were only allowed $2,500 to make a case. I called Miami, met with the director there, a good friend of mine, Jack, and Dave Connolly. And I said, look, this is BS. You're glad that I'm here, but $2,500, I want authorization on my own, $7,500 on a case to work undercover. I will work undercover with my guys and them. I brought in seven deputies, SLED agents, ad hoc, and I made us now hit the state. And we did. As a result, we made some of the biggest cases. I advised the U.S. attorney of his rights. He had tipped off a guy that had smuggled in a load and had him arrested. And the U.S. attorney said, "How dare?" I said, "The attorney general told me to advise you of your rights, you SOB. Good day." About 4 months later, he died of a heart attack. I arrested politicians, sheriffs, and police, and we went to town, and we became number one in the United States in making cases. Then there was a contract to have me killed by politicians and attorneys, and I was tipped off by the solicitor of Columbia, a good friend of mine. He was a non-Spurs person. He said, "They're going to kill you." Called me up at 2:30 in the morning, his wife, and says, "Jim wants to see you. They're going to kill you, Pete. Come to the house immediately." He told me the whole story and never advised my wife, told my guys what was going on. And next thing you know, this senior senator, Columbia, some two guys showed up at his house with hoods, and he stepped outside 3 o'clock in the morning, and they told him, they said, "You have a contract out on Mr. Charette and his family. Here's what's going to happen. If you follow through with this, your grandmother will be dug up and killed all over again. You will be killed, your daughter, your son, and your wife. You will disappear from the face of the earth. Call it off now. You got 24 hours. Within 24 hours, I get a phone call. Contract has been closed. That's when I got a call, believe it or not, I got a call from the drug czar in Washington, Dr. Carlton Turner, one of my best friends, and we're still friends. He was President Reagan's drug czar. And the phone rang. My son said, "The White House is on the phone." So I said, "Oh, that's Carlton." So I said, I answered the phone, "What the hell are you up to?" And he said, "Pete, we're on a conference call." I said, "Carlton, go F yourself." And all of a sudden, I hear this voice, "Hello, Mr. Charette." It was President Reagan. I almost hit the floor. And I said, "I apologize." Oops. And he's laughing. He goes, no. "Carlton told me about you." And he said, "The reason this call doesn't exist, God bless him, he's passed away." And he said, "There's a problem at the Atlanta office. Needs to be straightened out. Guys are coming in, drunk, lunchtime, etc." I said, "Well, to be very honest with you, Mr. President, I've heard about it, and it's a shame." He says, "Pete, Carlton says you're the only man that can go and clean up that office, and I understand there's a contract to have you killed. Would you accept my request to go there and be the supervisor and straighten up that office?" I says, "I work for you, Mr. President. I'm on." A month later, I was in Atlanta. Changed the entire office around, put a stop to all the craziness that was going on, warned everybody, and we started making cases. And the RAC, ASAC there, was a good friend. He passed away. And I told him in secret, I says, "Here's the reason why I'm here." And he went blank. I said, "You're a good man. You're too good. You don't want to hurt anybody. Let me straighten out your office." And I says, "And we're going to be making cases." And that by making cases, we did. Ended up in shootings, killing, etc. And we made cases. I arrested the biggest sheriff in Georgia and convicted him. He died in prison. And I arrested police chiefs, and we made cases with all the county deputies and all that. And as a result, Southern Comfort came into place. Mona Poland, who was a friend of mine who used to be with the Metro Dade Narcotics when I was a detective, Mona comes into the office, and she goes, "Frog, I got an informant, and he said that he's been requested to transport a shipment from Colombia from Pablo Escobar and Harold Rosenthal, who's a wanted fugitive by us." And he's willing to operate, and we can do the case. I said, "Mona, how many people do you need? She goes, well, this is going to be big because the mob is involved, U.S. mob. Mm-hmm. And Charles Alamo and Phil Bonadonna, two mobsters out of Fort Lauderdale, they had direct shipments from Pablo Escobar. And so we started the case, and there was just Mona and three agents and myself. I was working with them, and they were keeping me appraised. Next thing you know, we get started gotten Bonadonna and the Lamo came into Atlanta, delivered to my undercover agent $300,000-$400,000, bought an airplane, and we had an undercover pilot. And we had bought a stash house in the country out in Dallas, Georgia. And Southern Comfort became big. We got mm-hmm. shipments out of Tennessee, seized 250 kilos of cocaine, arrested Colombians with Uzi machine guns in their car, and the case got bigger and bigger. I involved, and I had good relationship with the FBI. And they were not active into narcotics like now they can do investigation. So I called the FBI and the ASAC, a friend of mine who was in a task force, presidential task force with me when I was transferred over to be represent DEA during Southern Comfort. And we got the FBI involved and we became the transporter bringing in shipments, and then we would seize them, and we brought in the entire conspiracy, the organization, there was 55 defendants when it was over, and they had brought in $8.3 billion worth of cocaine into the United States. We worked in Tennessee. Wow. We worked in North Carolina, New York, L.A., Florida, and we kept the operation going for 2.5 years undercover. During that time, our office in Medellin was, there was a two-man office there, and we had them put a wiretap on Harold Rosenthal, who was wanted and had escaped there, broke out of prison, and he was the broker for the U.S. mob working directly at Pablo's headquarters in Medellin, and as a result, Mike Vigil, who was head of the office there, Mike calls me up, and we told him, look, can you put a wire on Rosenthal? Our informant is in touch with him. So he said, you got it, Pete. So while we're doing our investigation, picking up shipments, bringing it in, during that time frame, my boss calls me in, Ray Vincic, God rest his soul, good guy. And he says, Pete, Channel 11 in Atlanta, their news guy is coming to the office. And he said that they intercepted a communication on a plane. And it sounded like a shipment of cocaine was coming to Atlanta. I said, oh, my God. Hmm. So he shows up and he sits down. He was a good friend of ours. He became a CBS guy. We made his career with this case. And he said, we intercepted this thing, and we heard this plane, and we knew it was coming from Colombia. And they said, it's coke time. That was a signal that he was coming into Atlanta. Mm-hmm. We think that's a drug operation. You guys know anything about it? Ray looked at me and I says, look, I'm going to tell you what's going on. I'm going to swear you in. You're not to do anything about this or mention anything. You will have the exclusive under this entire conspiracy, and you're going to become famous. He looked at me and I said, yeah, that's our plane. What we had done is we had sent a plane that we had purchased from the mob, and our pilot, we had put hidden speaking microphones on the plane, and we were monitoring him as he went. And it's when he landed, and he goes, and he was taxiing in to do the pickup, he says, oh, lots of gringos with machine guns. Oh, my God, Pablo is here.
In Atlanta?
Huh?
Is this in Columbia or in Atlanta?
In Columbia.
Okay.
And he said, Rosenthal is with them. We hear, hey, you're here, boom, boom, boom. And next thing, boom, boom, we hear the bales going into the plane. And he's saying to them, okay, I'm ready. You ready to go? They said, thank you. And they closed the door. And he took off, and he goes, oh, my God, I hope we can get over these trees because we're overloaded. And he flew over the trees, almost went right into them. He talking to us, and he lands at the Air Force base secretly. We pick up the shipment, take it to the safe house. Bonadonna and Al Lamo came up from Fort Lauderdale. And what we had done, we bought this house. And what I had the guys do and the team of all various cops that were working with us, we wired the entire house through the walls and then redid the walls before they came and they checked out the house just to be sure. They brought in an ex-cop from New York to do a search for any wiretaps in the house. And when he came, that's when we shut down all the microphones. And we were half a mile away, and I had guys from tech installed on a pole that was right across the street from the house, transformer pole. And we had a hidden camera there so we could see what was happening. And next thing they did, and it was a clean, he left. We flipped the mics back up.
Yeah.
They said, we want you guys, Lamo on them, we want you guys to buy two vehicles and have them ready for us when we arrive. And we're going to load up the shipment, take it to Fort Lauderdale. And at that point, I had went from three guys, I had like 27 police, FBI, local sheriffs working with us directly on this case. Mm-hmm. And we monitored everything and did surveillance. As a result, we got shipments after shipment. And one of the shipments that we got, it came into Tennessee. And our office from Tennessee asked them, you know, with the state police, they're going to come to this motel. The informant is driving. And he had a motorhome. Met these bad guys. And the agent in charge calls me up. It was Pete. Four guys came up. We've been working on these guys, and they're smugglers, marijuana smugglers and cocaine smugglers. And he says, they're loading up the bus. I said, okay, here's what you do. I says, he's been instructed, as soon as he leaves the motel, there's an exit. And I told him, get your bus a quarter full and tell them I got to pull in, load up for Florida. Pull in at the first exit and go and gas up. And then we will give the signal to move in because they'll go in and get something to drink and all that. It was three of them. So they pulled up to the gas station. Sure enough, the Cubans, they go in to get drinks and all that. And our agent says, move in. And everybody surrounded the place, move in. Inside the two cars were Uzi machine guns by the driver's seat. Their orders was, if you're stopped by any highway patrol or police, kill them. Seize the shipment. It was 250 kilograms of cocaine. And we arrested them. Now, panic sets in. Everybody's wondering, well, what the hell happened? And Pablo's on the phone talking to Rosenthal. And we need to know what's going on and what happened to our security. And next thing you know, we get a message that Pablo had a meeting with his staff. Rosenthal was there, and he assassinated, and the CI was there, assassinated his chief of security, walked behind him and blew his head for not doing his job properly. And the word got back to us and said, well, at least he's taken care of the situation for us. We're going to keep going. So during that time, we brought in shipments, and we were arresting some people. We followed that shipment all the way to Florida with airplanes and cars, and the delivery was made at a safe house. And then the local cops, we had them hit the house on a tip, and they couldn't figure out what the hell had happened. And we continued the operation. And then we get a message from Mike Vahil. He calls me up and goes, "Frenchie, have you heard the tap today?" I said, "No, I haven't gone to the wire room here," because they were directly feeding the wiretap on Harold's house to us also. And he says, "Rosenthal just called the head of cocaine operation for Sixto Granados." And Rosenthal calls him, and Sixto says to him, "Pablo just called me. We got to kill the Attorney General of Colombia. He's trying to extradite all of us, you included." And Pablo says, "Take him out." Says, "Mike, you talk to the embassy?" "Yeah, I talked to the guy in Colombia, in Bogota, the SAC, country attaché, I should say. Ambassador was notified. I notified Washington and all that." And Mike says to me, he goes, "Look, Colombians, they were protecting Rosenthal. They were getting paid off." He says, "The Colombian secret police told me, Das, that come and get Rosenthal. He's yours." So I says, "I'm flying in, myself, U.S. Marshal, and one agent." And I said, "We'll meet with you secretly, and we're going to take Rosenthal down." And I set up the operation with the DOS, and we started a movement from Rosenthal's house to the intersection that he came down the hill. Every morning he went to the Escobar building, and at 8 o'clock in the morning, and Sixto's Granados was driving the car, and we had practiced for a week timing of how long it took for him to go from his house to the traffic light T intersection. And we were clocking and having some of the covert cars go in front and behind him and slowing him down, where by the time he got to the bottom of the hill, the light was turning red. We did that for 12 days, and then we said, "It's time to hit him." He left the house, and we got behind him, and Sixto Granados, the head of the Barranquilla mob for Pablo, was driving, and we slowed him down, and sure enough, the time we got to the traffic light, people were just going to work and all that and crossing the... And we jumped out of the car. I ran to the car. The window was open. Harold had the window open, sitting on the passenger side. And I stuck the gun to his head and say, "Harold, DEA, United States, you're going home." He went flush. Pulled him out of the car. We took off with the U.S. Marshal, myself. There's pictures in the book of us sitting with Harold. And we flew him out of the country. Well, all hell broke loose, and I got, Harold was on the plane, and he told the guards on the plane, "I'd like to speak to Mr. Charette." So we had rented the back of the plane, no passengers, and we were flying to Miami. So I said, we sat down next to Harold, and I said, "There's a picture in the book." And I said, "Harold, you want to talk to me?" He goes, "Yes, sir." And he reaches out and he says, "I want to shake your hand." He says, "You got some set of balls." And I go, "Well, thank you for the compliment." He says, "Nobody ever expected this, and you did this. Good job." I says, "Harold, I appreciate that coming from you. That's a compliment."
Yep.
And he said, "One thing, Mr. Charette, get Mike Vahil and his agent and family out of Medellin, because Pablo said, if they ever come and take any of us, kill the heel and his partner and their family immediately." I got on the phone and called Mike, and I said, "Call the embassy, get the hell out of there." And they did. They closed up the office. prison didn't reopen, and we continued our investigation. Now, we brought him to Miami, and as a result, when he went to the detention center to be transported to Atlanta, he said to me, "Pete, I can't cooperate. I would be killed. Could you do me a favor?" I says, "Well, you did me a favor by alerting me for my guys from being killed with their family." I says, "Harold, I hope you're a man of your word. What do you need?" "I want to go to Atlanta prison because my family lives in Atlanta. Can you get me transferred there?" I said, "I'll work on it. You gave me something, and I will help you. Thank you, sir."
Mm-hmm.
So then we land. He goes to the detention center. I tell the director of the detention center, I said, "No, look, he already broke out of prison, paid $55,000 to be breakout. He went to Colombia, protected. He will try to break out of this place. Trust me." He says, "Pete, we'll watch out for it." I said, "Okay." Next thing I get a phone call from Miami. One of our agents in Miami says, "Pete, you got Rosenthal at the detention center. We have an informant there." Rosenthal asked him, "Do you know of anybody that could break me out of here? I'll pay $500,000. And I said, "Yeah, I know some people will do it." So I said, "Good, proceed." And I check in as cousins of Rosenthal come to see him. I alerted the director there. He says, "You got it, Mr. Pete." So the plan was, Harold said, they told him, "We will do it. Buy us a scarab. Transport you from here to the Bahamas. And then we'll fly you in to Colombia. We need $50,000 up front, 2 kilos of coke. We need a scarab boat to buy, and you got 24 hours, otherwise we ain't doing it. And what we'll do is we'll come in with a helicopter. The mound where outside where you go out on the mound and the walking area, we will come there at noontime, land the helicopters, and we'll kill all four tower watchers as we come in. And you be out on the yard, and we'll take you to the Bahamas." He loved it. So he calls me up, and he goes, "Pete, are you working on my transfer?" I says, "Harold, I told you. I owe you, and I'm working on it."
Mm-hmm.
"Okay, Pete, I really appreciate it." I was recording every one of these calls. He would call me once a week. What's the standing? And he was playing me, and I said, "Oh, I was recording everything." I said, "I got you, you son of a bitch." So next thing you know, the day of his escape, we got the scarab, we got the money and the cocaine, 15 kilos that was also given to the undercover guys that was going to take him out. And the day of reckoning comes, and all of a sudden, 5 minutes to 12, as he was telling them, "I'm ready to go out on the yard," the director with two guys says, "Harold, you're going to Atlanta. Mr. Charette arranged it for you, and you're going to Atlanta." Now, what was he going to say? "I'm supposed to escape?" And
I got a helicopter coming.
And he came to Atlanta. He calls me up, and he goes, "Pete, what the hell's going on?" I said, "Harold, is this how you thank me?" I said, "I got you where you wanted." And he was babbling, and I said, "Look, pal, I paid you back, and I thank you so much." And I told the director of the prison in his hand, and I said, "Watch him. He will try to escape." He planned an escape, but he wasn't successful. Long story short, we ended up arresting nationwide 55 defendants, biggest cocaine conspiracy in the history of the United States. 2 years of work, we faked. When they suspected that one of our pilots was possibly the one that was tipping off the authorities, they told LaManna and them, "Kill the pilot." And my agents said, "Boss, what are we going to do?" I said, "We're going to kill the pilot. Are you crazy?" I said, "No." I said, "I got a friend in Hollywood. He can help me." So I called up this friend. He died. He was an actor, great guy. And I said, "I need some help. What do you need, Pete?" I said, "Look, I need some makeup guys to come in and make this guy look like he was killed in a crash. I'm working a big case. I need your help." "You got it." Then faked a car crash and had the car crash in the newspaper saying that this guy had been killed, blah, blah, blah. They sent the newspaper articles to Escobar and Harold. They were as happy as could be, and we continued the investigation. Then finally, when they gave the order to have, we intercepted the order that they wanted Laura Bonilla, the Attorney General of Colombia, who was working with us to extradite Escobar and the whole gang, Rosenthal included. Mm-hmm. When that was intercepted, that's when they told us, "Come and get." Well, when we got that thing, within 8 hours, Laura Bonilla was assassinated going home by two motorcycle guys. And they said, "That's it. Come in and get Rosenthal." And we ended up arresting 55 defendants. Attorney General of the United States called this the biggest cocaine conspiracy in the history of the United States. I had almost 55 agents. We worked 24 hours a day on this case for 2.5 years. Best agents in the world. And we took the biggest cocaine conspiracy people in the world down, the mob and everybody. And when Harold appeared in court, and you can picture this, the 55 defendants in the courtroom, they had to go in the room where they swore people in as citizens, gigantic courtroom. And I'm sitting at the desk with the U.S. attorney. Harold's sitting with his attorney, and the rest of the goons were all with their attorney. And the judge read the indictment and all that, 52 pages long. And he said, "We're going to take a break." So took a break. Harold's attorney comes over and he goes, "Mr. Rosenthal would like to speak to Mr. Charette." The judge had said, after he read the entire indictment, "Oh, I have one indictment to unseal as of now." And he reads the thing, and I walk over to Harold, and it said that I had communicated with him and arranged all these things and all that and was playing him. And I says, "Harold, you want to talk to me?" And U.S. attorney standing there. He goes, "Pete," shakes my hand. He says, "You know what? You did it honestly. I respect you. Damn good job, pal." I says, "Harold, I had to do what I did. You helped save my agents from being killed." And I said, "I paid you back, but you wanted to pursue this even longer? You can't do it. It's time. It's up." They were all convicted to life in prison for almost 2 years. For almost 2 years, Harold used to send me a Merry Christmas card from the prison. Jeez. And that was Southern Comfort. When it was done, the news guy became CBS top newsman, and we exposed this, and it was quite an honor. And I put in, believe it or not, Steve, I'm a man that believes that you give credit to where it belongs, and you recognize your people when they do something great. I've always done that with you guys. And I, myself and Vincent, wrote up 55 people, FBI agents, South Carolina, Tennessee agents and all that, and deputy sheriffs. We wrote them up to get the Attorney General's award for making this case. And it was a joint effort by all agencies. It went to headquarters, Steve. with the embarrassment, and I say it in the book, in the second book. It was the biggest embarrassment. The director, ex-FBI agent, calls Vincic and myself and says, I've got the thing here. I refuse to sign it unless you put this man's name in it. And he gives us the name, who was going to be a new ASAC in Atlanta. He was at his horse hole. Vincic's looking at me, and he's going, Pete, and I'm shaking my head. I said, sir, with all due respect, withdrawing that request. We're not putting that man's name in because he had nothing to do with this. How dare you talk to me that way? I says, calling it like it is. I don't play politics. These are my agent. These my friends are liaison people. They deserve this honor. Boom. He hangs up on me. Next thing you know, I get a call, Ross Perot. I want to honor you and your boss and the director and your agents, five of them, to come to Dallas. We're going to have a supper in your honor for making the most historical case in history. You guys are true Americans. You talk about an honesty. And he honored us. God bless him. He passed away. I ran into him 2 years later when I was in headquarters. I'm coming out lunch with a couple of guys. Taxi pulls up. Here's the one of the most richest person in the United States. Taxi pulls up. He gets out of the car, and I said to the guys, hey, there's Ross Perot. As he comes up the step to the building, he goes, Pete, how are you? He remembered me. And they were... their mouth was gaping. I said, I'm meeting this. They're shaking hands. I says, Ross, what are you doing? Oh, I'm meeting the boss, Jack. You got something going? Yep. I says, way to go. He said, yeah. Texas, you better be calling me. That was the biggest honor. And we put in everybody, and we were denied the honor to get that award. But Ross Perot came through. And I had the best team in the world. DEA in those days were the best. You did your job.
Yeah.
You made me so proud. And I'm honored to have been on your show. And I hope that we will see each other soon.
Well, absolutely. And I got some questions. Yeah, I got some questions. So is Rosenthal, is he still alive?
Yep. Harold's still in prison, but he got life plus. So he's not coming out.
Yeah.
But even though he was vicious and all that, and he worked directly as the broker for the U.S. mob, but I had that experience not only with him, but when I worked on the French Connection with the Corsican mob, when we arrested Salvatore Lamano, which was one of the biggest cocaine case ever made. And Salvatore, he was a fugitive from the United States, and I made the case against him. I was going to transport the shipment of 20 kilos that he was delivering at the train station. And one of the crooked French police officer tipped them off as they were delivering to us. And he said on the phone, get out of there. They're on to you. And he hung up. That's when the director narcotics called me and says, Pete, it's blown. Arrest everybody. We arrested everybody. Then I went to his office, and he said, I want you to listen to this recording. As soon as I heard the voice, I said, that son of a bitch. He was a Corsican, a born guy, and he was tipping off the French Connection on what we were doing at times. And I said, where is he? He says, he's already in jail, Pete. Don't worry. We took care of him. So, but Rosenthal, a lot of the French Connection guys, even after I was exposed and they knew that I was, and they held me at gunpoint saying you're an agent and all that, they threatened to kill me, and I talked my way out of it. Some of them, a couple of them that kind of rolled over, cooperate, when they saw me, they said, we want to shake your hand. You did it good. You were honest.
Yep. The informant that you used in the case that flew down that they were going to kill, That sounds very familiar to Barry Seal. I know it wasn't because it's a different time frame.
Yes. Let me just say this about him. He cooperated because he got tipped off that he suspected that he had spotted surveillance cars while we were investigating this, and he spotted surveillance cars. He was a retired military officer in charge of radar coming out of the Caribbean.
So he knew all about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
wow.
When we got word that he had called and wanted to meet with us, and I was told, and he came in and he started telling us, blah, 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 this is it, that, and I was called by Harold. He wanted me to transport, help him again. And I did stuff for him in the past, but now I want to help you guys because I don't want to be arrested. He was, he was a piece of shit, okay?
Yeah.
Be blunt. And the agent that controlled him got a little too friendly with him. And unfortunately, it caused some problems. And when we made the delivery, we were waiting for the U.S. attorney to give us the go signal to deliver the shipment. And the agent and this SOB were at a McDonald's parking lot nearby, about a mile away from the house. And I was there with one agent who had gone to Columbia with me. And he said to me, he said, look, I'm not waiting anymore. I got to deliver it. I said, no, you're not delivering until the U.S. attorney says go. Next thing you know, I almost got run down.
Wow.
Wow. Yes. So there was some crazy stuff that happened when I went to Columbia. Of course, we had gotten word that Harold was going to meet Laura Bonilla. And I went there because U.S. attorney says, look, we need to have Rosenthal in person surveil and show that he is with these people. Well, Bonilla had called him to Barranquilla to come, because they had to have a meeting, because Pablo was concerned about what all these seizures. And I said, I'm going there. And I said to my agent, you're coming with me, but you're not going to be walking around and all that in the hotel. I got arrangements from our agent in Barranquilla to go to this hotel, and we're going to register. I got a Canadian passport. I'm a Canadian. So we got there, we checked in. Now, as you walked into the hotel, there was a casino to the right, and then a dining room to the left from the front desk. When I walked in, people are playing in the casino and all that, loud noise and all that. So we go to our room, and I got a room facing the street on the third floor, right where the entrance is, and I can see across the street where people would park. And my agent was in another room, and I told him, do not get out of your room at all. Why? No. So he didn't hear today, but he did not like me, but I didn't give a damn. I did it, and I had certain techniques, and I learned through my career how things can go wrong. So I saw convoy of five black sedans pull up. Guys get out. I'm telling you, Steve, for real. These guys get out with Uzis, machine gun, to protect Laura Bonilla. They cross the street and they go in. I said, okay, I'm going to give them 15 minutes because I had to verify that Rosenthal was there with him. And the meeting was occurring, and so now we could say, yes, they went part with him. I went downstairs, and elevator doors open. I walk, and I glance over to my right to the restaurant, empty, just all lights off, just a table, and there's Bonilla and Harold, candle, plop. I walked up, grabbed a newspaper, got back on the elevator, back up. We confirmed it.
Was there indication that, so this is, we're talking about Rodrigo Laura Bonilla. Was there indication that he was corrupt?
No.
Laura Bonilla, the gym minister of justice.
Laura Bonilla was not corrupt. He was working with us to get the indictments going, and he had gotten the green light, and that's when they killed him. And we tried to give him a message, and he thanked us. He was very polite and all that. And then he got into his car. As he drove down the street, two motorcycles came up. That's it. They killed him. That's when everything broke. And we said, okay, let's round up and take him down. So
I was just going to say that Javier and I were in Norway speaking. This was before COVID. And we were hitting all the Scandinavian countries. We were on a two-week tour. And after we spoke in one of the Norwegian cities, you know, we're in the green room afterwards and relaxing, waiting for everybody to leave. And security came in and said, hey, there's a gentleman out here that's from Colombia that would like to speak to you guys. So we said, sure. You know, he said, a young man. So we said, send him in. Security was there. And the guy comes in and he said, hey, I just wanted to tell you, just listen to your story. Great job. Thank you for telling the truth. Just so you know my history, my uncle was Rodrigo Lara Bonilla. And when he was killed, he said, I was an infant. And so our whole family, within just a matter of a couple of days after Lara Bonilla's death, packed up and moved to Norway because Escobar was going to kill the whole family, which he was infamous for, right? This kid didn't speak any Spanish. He spoke whatever, the Norwegian language. But it's just amazing. And we told him, hey, you know what? Your uncle was a hero. He had the stones to call out Pablo Escobar and open Congress and call him what he was, a drug trafficker and a murderer, and that's why he got kicked out of Congress. Just out of curiosity, did this investigation, was that part of the indictments against Pablo Escobar down the road?
Yeah. If Pablo was mentioned in it, of course, we couldn't arrest him, and I would love to come there, be with you on that deal. But you did a good job. a good job, pal.
We'll give all the credit to Colombia National Police because they took their country back.
Exactly.
That's what they did.
I was invited here recently to go to Marseille. They were going to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the French Connection, and they wanted me to come down, and they called off the program because of the weather and all that. But now French television is doing a narco series of French Connection. For 2 years, I've been working with them. And now, after December the 1st episode is going to be aired, and they're using my interview that they did for almost 5 hours with me and using all my material in my cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to have a French Connection like a narco.
Cool, very cool.
Yeah, and I'm getting a lot of offers, phony offers, Steve, and I'm sure you've faced it with people who say, hey, I'm with such and such studio. We want to buy the rights to your book, but you'll have to pay us $10,000. And I say, and that's it.
There's a scam every day. You know, there's a new scam every day. It's amazing.
Yeah. Thank God that I have you. I ask for your advice at times. And now I have a friend in Hollywood. Jerry Petrovich is his name. Ex-Secret Service. Was in Paris. And his office was right next to us. And he and I were best of friends. He used to put security on, what's her name, the president that got killed there, Kennedy.
In France?
Yeah. And he used to do the security at the mansion in Paris. We used to do the town at nighttime after he got off the job. And we used to go and have a fun time. Till this day, we're still in contact. But I've contacted him. Now he's coming out with another movie and another book, and he's had three movies made. And his first movie was To Live and Die in L.A. I don't know if you ever saw it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And he's been giving me advice. And he said, if they call you, call me. My agent will be in touch with them. Say, send a check and send it by mail. Don't accept anything else and don't give them any money. So we're having fun.
yep. So you've got your second book out now. Your first one was One Hell of a Ride. I'm looking at it here on screen here. And now second book is One Hell of a Ride 2. So this is the sequel. And I love it. So the first one is One Hell of a Ride, The Investigative and Undercover Life of a DEA Agent. And then the second book is One Hell of a Ride 2, From the French Connection to Operation Southern Comfort. So for our listeners, we've just scratched the surface. That was a multi-year investigation. Just due to time constraints, we only scratched the surface of the investigation. So I highly encourage you to take a look at that book, support Pete here. His website is Pete Charette, and that's C-H-A-R-E-T-T-E, PeteCharetteBooks.com. You can also, all you have to do is Google Pete Charette, and you'll see it's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. It's on booksellers that I've never even heard of.
YouTube.
Yep. You've got a lot of interviews. This interview will be on YouTube, just so you know, Pete.
Okay, thank you so much.
Those that are watching it on YouTube, you know it's on YouTube because you're watching it right now. But I tell you what, brother, this is – some people probably think Murph just keeps bringing his old friends in. Well, yes, I am, but it's friends with stories and history, but I bring on the best guests. I bring on people that you're not going to hear anywhere else.
Steve, I got one thing to say. Right now, with the stuff that's coming through Mexico, the
fentanyl.
Fentanyl. All I got to say on that is that right now, there's a solution to it. There's a solution to stop the whole thing. And I hope whoever becomes president, I know I risked my life all over Europe, behind the Iron Curtain, Colombia, and everything, because of the drug problem that's occurring in the United States. And with this type of drug coming across Mexico, I'll be honest, they're allowing it to happen. Mm-hmm. They're being controlled by the Sinaloa cartel. And if someone had, I'll use the word balls, mm-hmm. to do something about it, it can be accomplished. I guarantee you, if they gave us a green light and various agencies had the right to go ahead and do what I'm saying, we could go in there, covertly assassinate every cartel member and get rid of the Mexican cartel, the fentanyl problem, and we can do that at every country that has an organization that's sending drugs to the United States. That's the only way you'll solve the problem. Otherwise, corruption, money talks, bullshit walks. You know it, I know it. Mm-hmm. And I've said a lot of speaking engagement. If DEA or whoever, the President of the United States, call me and say, Pete, we think it can be done. We want you to be involved. I'm in. Because yep. it can be done. We can wipe out all the world's cartel in 2 years. When I was working the French Connection, I had put in and saying, we need to assassinate the Corsican mob in Marseille, and we need to do a covert operation. Everybody agreed, even the French police agreed, and then Washington says, nope, we were going to do it.
Yeah, it's just not going to happen.
You can only do so much, and what's happening is a disaster. Fentanyl is killing thousands of people, and we're allowing them to come in. The cartel is behind it. The Mexican government is behind it. They're being run and paid for by the cartel. You know it. I know it. You've seen it. And I think it's time that we in America step up to the plate and put a stop to all this drug that's killing people in our country, kids. We don't need that.
Yeah. You know what, Pete? When they came out with that term, war on drugs, in my opinion, that's the biggest misnomer the government has ever come out with, because there's never been 100% commitment from Washington to attack these problems that are just decimating our country. And nothing's changed. It's worse now than it was 20, 30 years ago.
Yep.
For our listeners there, are we condoning murder? No, that's not what this is all about. We're discussing about how you would attack people that are murdering our citizens. But the truth is, without being political here, we don't want to go down that road for Game of Crimes, but it's just not going to happen. So it's not to take anything away from the brave men and women who are out there fighting the battle every day. I love them. My hat's off to them. They are true patriots and American heroes because they're willing to risk their own lives to protect all of us.
God bless you.
Pete, it's been a hoot having you back on here. Thank you so much for giving us your time and coming back for another couple of hours. Hope our paths cross again here soon. I haven't seen you in person for a number of years. I think the last time was up in Atlanta.
Yeah. So, well, I'll be going to Florida for Thanksgiving, and I'll give you a shout.
If you're through Orlando, brother, give me a shout while we're here. All the family's coming down.
I'll be in touch, I promise, and thank you so much. And you're doing a fantastic job. And Steve, we were brothers for life.
Absolutely. So for all our listeners, thank you once again for joining us here on Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. I was saying stand by for the debrief, but we've kind of changed that around a little bit. So I just want to say thank you for joining us again. We look forward to seeing you next week. God bless. Well, unfortunately, that's it for this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Thank you, folks, so much for taking the time to see and hear some of the best true crime content you can find anywhere. None of this would be possible without your support. If you didn't know this already, Game of Crimes is now on YouTube. Just type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the YouTube search bar. You can send me your comments on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or to our email address, which is gameofcrimespodcast@gmail.com. Our website, it's gameofcrimespodcast.com. That's where you'll find all our episodes, books written by our guests, merchandise, and more. If you're looking for even more content, now go over to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and sign up. There you'll find several bonus episodes each month, ranging from serious and current topics to some silly and fun events. And you can even get early access to each week's interviews before they drop on YouTube or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can even subscribe for free and hear the first 5 minutes of each episode, and that's to help you decide if you'd like to spend some of your hard-earned cash to hear more. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. To all our guests here on Game of Crimes, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show. I mean that sincerely. Thank you for your service to your communities, your countries, and for taking the time to tell us about your adventurous lives. May God bless and protect all the men and women in law enforcement, our military, and all of our first responders. And you know what? This goes for all of our listeners as well. Thank you for your continued support. And just one last thought here. It's okay for us to have different ideas and different opinions, but it doesn't mean we can't continue to be friends. All right. My final thank you. Thanks for joining me again to play the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. I'll see y'all next week.